This is the Takeaway Weekender. I'm Todd Zwillick. Thank you so much for listening. It seems every week we have another name to add to the list of young African Americans who've lost their lives or suffered brutality at the hands of police, corrections officers, the judicial system, even average citizens who feel threatened and invoke stand your ground laws. On June 19th, a new documentary chronicling the trial of Michael Dunn opens for wide release. Dunn was convicted of murder in the loud music shooting death of Jordan Davis back in 2012.
Was there music playing in the car while the three of you were waiting for Tommy Storms?
Yes.
And what type of music was playing?
Rap.
What was the volume of the music?
It's pretty loud.
Did the defendant say anything about the music when he parked the car next to the red car?
Yes.
And what did the defendant say?
Oh, I hate that thug music.
Kristen Meinzer, the cultural producer at The Takeaway and co-host of the Movie Date podcast, had a chance to sit down with Jordan's father, Ron, to talk about his son, and director Mark Silver on what he hopes this film will accomplish.
Ron Davis, Mark Silver, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Ron, if you could just start off by telling us a little bit about your son, Jordan.
Jordan, he was born in Atlanta, Georgia, and he came to live with me. We lived together there. And when I moved from Atlanta to Jacksonville, me and his mother had separated. And he came to live with me at the age of 15 when he came. And he liked Jacksonville. He went to school at Samuel Wilson High School. He was a leader, you know. Him and his friends liked to play basketball and liked to play PlayStation and all that stuff that young kids like to do. But this main thing was music. You know, he loved mixing tapes with his friends. And so it's really a cruel thing to know that my son's life was taken because of loud music, because that's what he loved. Well, he loved music. And Jordan, he just was a light. You know, when he got into a room and he smiled, no matter what was going on in that room, you know, everybody was happy in that room. You know, I can't remember many sad moments with Jordan. And so it's just so unusual, you know, to see that such a light was taken away from us. And that's why I decided as a parent that I was going to do something. I wasn't going to let my son die, my son's spirit die, that I'm going to let his spirit live on. And his legacy would be that he would just light up this world, just absolutely light up this world.
The man who killed Jordan, Michael Dunn. Mark, can you tell us about him?
Yeah, he's a 45-year-old, I think, computer engineer, and he was in Jacksonville for his son's wedding, and he hadn't seen his son for many, many years. They were estranged, and they had just sort of built up their relationship again because of the son's wedding. He was with his partner at the time, fiancé at the time, Rhonda Rauer, and they pulled into the gas station car park in Jacksonville, right next to the car that Jordan was in. And an argument ensued over the volume of the music that was coming from the car Jordan was in.
And Ron, can you pick up the story from there about what happened with Jordan then?
Yes. The boys had been at Town Center, which is an outdoor mall, and he wanted to go there and see his girlfriend. You know, he saw her. And then they were on their way back and going to another mall in Jacksonville, Florida. And they stopped to get gum and... when they stopped, they were already there playing their music. One car drove up and heard the music and pulled into another spot, which is the responsible thing to do if you don't want to hear music somewhere, you know, and you're in an outdoor place like a convenience store. You just move and move your car. Michael Dunn drove up right afterwards and parked real close right next to the other car. And the first thing he said to his fiance was, "I hate that thug music." And everybody around the United States knows that now the new thug word is the new N-word, you know. And he's basically, you know, racial profiling these kids within seconds of driving up. You know, he said, "I hate that thug music." So how do you know my son's a thug all of a sudden? And that's your mindset. So he rolls down the window and he tells them to cut their music down. And here you are in a public place. So as kids do, they roll it down, but then my son says, "Roll it back. You know, put the music back up. He shouldn't be able to tell us what to do, you know, and stop our music." So they cut the music back up. And he decided to have a verbal confrontation with my son. My son never got out of the car. None of the kids got out of the car except for the driver. He was already in the store. And they started arguing with Mr. Dunn. And he decided that this was the time that he was going to take his gun out of his glove compartment. And as the other kid got it back in the car to drive away, had he waited 20 seconds, these kids wouldn't have been there. You know, all this would have not happened. And that's another thing that pains me, is because the driver of the car had come back out of the store, danced a little bit to the music, got back in the car to drive away. But Michael Dunn, he is just so depraved that he decided that he couldn't even wait 20 seconds for that car to leave. He decided he was going to show these kids that they can't talk back to him. And he starts shooting 10 shots into this car, you know. And that's what's so unusual about that, that he ended my son's life and he also ended his own life, because now he's in prison for the rest of his life, life imprisonment with no chance of parole. And I thought that that was just 3.5 minutes, as this film says, of action of Michael Dunn took two lives away.
Mark, I wanted to ask you a question about Michael Dunn and his own testimony. When he was testifying for himself, he was saying, "I was afraid for my life." Now, we know that these are four middle-class kids who are sitting in their own car. They're not coming at him. But do you think that despite the circumstances, there's any chance, because of the social climate, because of the country we live in, that he might have been speaking the truth in any way at all, that he was afraid?
I think that Michael Dunn spoke the truth in the sense that he believed he was afraid. I think that's one. I think that's his truth. That doesn't mean that it's the truth or that he had anything to be afraid of. And I think that the way Michael Dunn had been conditioned to look at young black men was that they were all a potential threat to him, and therefore he believed that he was scared. If he would have been brought up in a different way, or looked at the world in a different way, or even took a step back for a couple of seconds, he would have maybe been able to perceive that situation in a way that he would have looked at the boys and seen that in fact there was no weapon, there was no gun, there was no threat. And all of that was just playing out in his mind. But having spent so long, you know, working on the film and listening to and watching Michael Dunn, both on the stand and in his initial police interviews, which we got the CCTV footage of, I believe that he believes the boys were a threat. And I think that's what's so interesting about making a film about a trial, that you get to see that there are, through the prosecution and defence, many different versions of the so-called truth. And in many ways, I think in the first trial, where a mistrial was declared because the jury couldn't come to a decision on whether he was guilty or not, I think in many ways it felt like it was who told the best story that would actually win that trial. And the defense lawyer was so good at spinning this idea that the boys did have a gun, that fear was justified, that he confused the jury so much. And I think he raised in them this almost subconscious feeling that maybe Michael Dunn was right. You know, maybe I, as a jury member, would have also felt fear. And he was tapping into that kind of conditioning that we all receive from mainstream media when it comes to how young black men are portrayed. Mm-hmm.
And Ron, this case really hinged on the testimony of his girlfriend, of Michael Dunn's girlfriend.
When you came out of the Gate gas station and you got into the defendant's car?
Yes.
Did the defendant ever tell you he saw a gun in that red SUV?
No.
Did the defendant ever tell you that he saw a weapon of any kind in that SUV?
No.
There was no mention of a stick?
No.
There was no mention of a shotgun?
No.
There was no mention of a barrel?
No.
There was no mention of a lead pipe?
No.
Back in the hotel room, Miss Rauer, that same night, did the defendant ever tell you that he saw the boys with a firearm?
No.
Did he ever tell you that he saw the boys with a weapon?
No.
On the 2-hour drive the following morning, did the defendant ever tell you that he saw a gun in the SUV?
No.
And on that 2-hour drive, did he ever tell you he saw a weapon of any kind in that SUV?
No.
Were you surprised at all that she was so honest on the stand?
I wasn't surprised about that. It's because that, you know, she actually jumped in the car with him, had an opportunity when they drove away to flag down a policeman. A policeman was right there when he drove out of the driveway because they had a traffic stop right there. And so they saw the policeman, and she didn't flag down the policeman, so she gets back to the hotel. You know, if she knows that she was with somebody involved in a shooting, she had an obligation to call the police and say, I know about the shooting, and especially when she found out my son died, you know. And she woke up that morning and knew my son died and still did not contact Jacksonville Sheriff's Office. And she drove 2.5 hours with this man who had just killed and murdered my son. And so she had an obligation to do that. And I think that what drove her to testify against him was that she, somewhere in the back of her mind, felt that she was wrong in what she did, and she may be charged also, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that was the thing. I don't think she did it out of kindness for the family or feeling that type of regret. And I think after reflection, especially during the second trial, after reflecting about what happened and what he did, that she was horrified that she almost married a guy like this.
Mm. Just a few months before Jordan's killing, we had Trayvon Martin's case also in Florida, just a few months earlier. And did you and Jordan actually sit down and have talks with each other about, this is America, this is how America perceives and treats young black men right now, and this is what we have to be aware of and what we have to do to take care of ourselves?
Yes, it was. We had the conversation about that, about how any men or women of color are being treated in America. That's why there's so many hashtags, Black Lives Matter. You know, we never say that white lives don't matter. That's a given. But we're saying that, you know, Black Lives Matter, too, that you can't just take our life and expect no consequences. And so when we looked at what happened with Trayvon and George Zimmerman got off on that, I remember, and I'll never forget what the jury said. One of the jurors said, we didn't connect with Trayvon. We connected with Georgie, you know. So in a trial, it's the trial of George Zimmerman. It wasn't a trial of Trayvon Martin. Trayvon Martin just a player in this, you know. He's just a victim in this. And so they never get to show Trayvon Martin, you know, where he's playing with his family and engaging his family. They only show George doing that. Same thing with Michael Dunn. They never show Jordan Davis engaging with his family. They told us we can only show the ID picture that he had, like his driver's license ID picture. We couldn't show him interacting with other family members. We couldn't show Jordan at a wedding. We couldn't show Jordan doing anything like that. It wasn't appropriate because it was Michael Dunn's trial. It was his show. So he was allowed to do that. He was allowed to show pictures of him humanizing him. But at the same time, we can't humanize the victim. You know, Jordan Davis, as a matter of fact, we were told by the judge, they couldn't even call Jordan Davis a victim because it would sound like Michael Dunn was already guilty. So Jordan Davis, after 3 shots in the chest, was not being called a victim in court. And that's ridiculous. And so I think black men all over this country, they have the conversation with their children, whether it be men children or women children. You know, what happened in McKinney, Texas recently, where the young lady, 14 years old in a bathing suit, gets dragged across the ground, you know, just at a pool party. That's ridiculous, you know. And then the cop pulls a gun on these 14 and 15-year-old children without any provocation. You know, it's happening across the country. And so these are the things that we look at as African-Americans and say, this has to stop. You know, how can we stop it? It's not just the laws that's going to stop it. What's going to stop it is the change in hearts and the change in minds to say that, you know what, we're not the people that are being portrayed on the screen. You know, when you look at movies, who are the people in movies that are shown as drug dealers? Most of the time it's people of color or Latinos. Who are the people that are shown as prostitutes on movies? When you go on TV and you see shows like Cops, or who's always handcuffed? It's people of color handcuffed, and it's always somebody in authority. It's usually a white supremacist-looking person in authority. And I tell people, it's not white people that we should fear as black or people of color. It's white supremacists. There's a difference between white people and white supremacists. White supremacist means that you think that we should go back to the 1940s and the 1950s. You think that everybody that has color on their skin is a potential threat and they need to be locked up. And that's why we have such mass incarceration in this nation.
Now, Mark, when you were making this film, you were dealing with this time period, with this particular case. Were you surprised by the timing of this, that now it's coming out and it feels more timely than ever with everything that's happening in the world right now?
Yeah, it was I remember the first time that we kind of had that realization. We were a couple of months into the edit, a few months into the edit, and Ferguson erupted. And I remember I had I had my laptop running that was showing the news from Ferguson, and you know the other computers in the room where we were editing the film. And suddenly, you know, the film just spoke back to us very differently to how it had done, and the way that we saw the film had dramatically evolved, that we knew that what was in the DNA of this film, in the DNA of Jordan's story, and the way that Michael Dunn perceived Jordan, that DNA was the same in all these other cases that were popping up around America at the time. And by the time we finished the film, there had been several other cases. And I think also I came to feel that by the end of the film, the 3.5 minutes where Jordan and Michael Dunn met, you know, could have metaphorically been the couple of seconds it took where the police shot Tamir Rice, or the 4 hours that Michael Brown was lying on the ground in Ferguson. Suddenly, the film just resonated in a way and spoke to and for many, many other situations that were unfolding in the U.S.
Now, this film is part of the Human Rights Watch Film Festival. It's been picked up by HBO. It's going to be in theaters very soon. Who are you hoping will watch this movie, and who is this movie for? Both of you.
I think that it's for people that are on the line, the people that are liberal, the people that haven't taken a stance one way or the other. And I think this film can move people, can let you see what's happening and what you see, the devastation to the families. You know, so many times that we see the Mike Brown situation, we know the shooter, and we know the victim. You know, when you look at a lot of these situations, whether it be Oscar Grant out in Oakland, California, we know the shooter and we know the victim. But we never hear about the families, you know, what the devastation is that we have to carry in our hearts and souls trying to go and navigate our way through the court system to get justice for our loved ones, number one. And then once you navigate the court system, then you have to sit back and say, well, what are you going to do about the loss of your loved ones? Are you going to make films? Are you going to write books? Are you just going to sit at home and just suffer, suffer, suffer for the rest of your life? Because once that victim is gone, you have hundreds of family members and friends and supporters. What are they left with after that? And so that's one of the things that Mark Silver does so well, is that show this is the devastation of what happens to families once you kill one of their family members.
I think for me, it's for all different types of audiences, and the film is constructed in a way that different moments speak to different audiences. I think I'm particularly interested in seeing how it resonates with white audiences and how it gives them an opportunity to potentially reflect on their own biases, whether they were, you know, conscious biases or unknown subconscious biases. I think that could be very interesting for audiences.
Well, Ron Davis and Mark Silver, thank you so much for joining us here in studio today to talk about 3.5 minutes, 10 bullets.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway and co-host of the Movie Date podcast, talking with Ron Davis and Mark Silver. I'm Todd Zwillick. Thanks for listening to this edition of The Takeaway Weekender. We'll see you on Monday. Until then, check out everything at thetakeaway.org. Have a great weekend.
This has been the Takeaway Weekender podcast. You can catch all our show's content by visiting us at thetakeaway.org. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/thetakeaway and follow us on Twitter using the handle @thetakeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.